Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Unsafe Injection Practices, Outbreaks, Incidents, and Root Causes, which is certified by Medscape and presented by David Pegues, MD, Karen Hoffman, RNMS, Joseph Purs, DRPH, MA, and Robin Stackhouse, MD. Dr. Pegues is a professor of clinical medicine, David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, hospital epidemiologist, Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center, Los Angeles, California. Dr. Pegues has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Pegues does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Pegues does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Ms. Hoffman is a clinical instructor, Division of Infectious Diseases, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Ms. Hoffman has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as an advisor or consultant for the American Medical Association. Ms. Hoffman does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Ms. Hoffman does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Purs is a team leader, Ambulatory and Long-Term Care, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Department of Health and Human Services, Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Purs has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Purs does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Purs does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Stackhouse is a clinical professor of anesthesia, University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Stackhouse has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Stackhouse does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Stackhouse does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The goal of this activity is to enhance awareness of safe injection practices and the need to implement appropriate protocols and practices to prevent transmission of infectious diseases between one patient and another or between a patient and a healthcare provider. This activity is supported by the CDC Foundation. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. David Pegues, and I'd like to welcome you to the CME and CE certified program titled Unsafe Injection Practices, Outbreaks, Incidents, and Root Causes. I'd also like to welcome my colleagues, Karen Hoffman, Dr. Robin Stackhouse, and Dr. Joe Purs. Safe injection practices, or injection safety, really is at the intersection of the two major patient safety initiatives, the prevention of healthcare-associated infections and medication safety. And although this has received increased regulatory and administrative oversight, as well as scrutiny by patients and their families in the acute care setting, many of the examples that we're going to discuss today have taken place outside the traditional four walls of the acute care medical center. What happens when these safe injection practices are not followed? Well, the literature is replete with examples of dramatic outbreak investigations. It's estimated that over 125,000 patients and their loved ones have been notified and stressed, to say the least, by dozens of incidents of potential exposure to blood-borne pathogens, including hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and HIV, but also potential exposures with significant health consequences to bacterial pathogens, including bloodstream infection or meningitis, as well as at least one example of a parasitic outbreak investigation. Robin, where are we dropping the ball?
Well, I think there are three ways that this occurs. One is a total lack of knowledge about what safe injection practices actually are. The next one is where people understand what safe injection practices are, but they have not translated it into practice adequately. And the third would be malfeasance, where, say, in the situation where somebody is diverting narcotics for their own use.
I think a great example of assumptions being made is the Colorado Pediatric Clinic, where there was a notification that had to go out to hundreds of people because at this place a medical assistant was actually using the same syringe to give flu vaccine to more than one patient. So what happened here was the medical assistant was responsible for drawing up the dose for a patient, but then they removed the needle after they'd drawn up the full dose, gave half the dose, and stored the needle and syringe for a second dose to be given later. This resulted in dozens of children potentially being exposed. And I think assumptions here is a great example of they assumed that the medical assistant knew what to do, and this case obviously didn't.
Exactly.
Not a safe assumption. What about issues in adherence to safe injection practices?
Well, you know, what we find is that while overall adherence to good practice is relatively high, there's an unacceptable gap there. Injection safety is so critical that, you know, even a small percentage of providers practicing unsafely is simply not acceptable, you know, in this day and age. One of the things that we do emphasize is that safe injection practices are part of standard precautions, which is CDC's evidence-based guidelines that lay out basically the minimum expectations for safe care. Aspects of care including, for example, hand hygiene and environmental cleaning, and as well as a section on safe injection practices. And one of the central issues to safe injection practice is that syringe reuse is inherently dangerous. So we like to say that syringe reuse is represents low-hanging fruit with regard to prevention. If we can educate providers and help them understand that syringe reuse must be avoided, we'll go a long ways towards assuring safe practice in any healthcare setting. Something that gives us pause, in addition to the many outbreaks which we have investigated, and we'll describe some of those momentarily, is that when we survey healthcare providers, we continue to find a small percentage that indicate they're doing things like reusing syringes for multiple patients or reusing syringes to access medications. And again, even a small percentage of providers practicing unsafely is simply not acceptable. So, David, to begin, let's emphasize direct syringe reuse. That's the term that we use to describe when a syringe is used for more than one patient. We have an example of that just mentioned in the Colorado incident. And again, this is, you know, infection control 101.
So another example of an outbreak that resulted from direct reuse was what happened in actually in Oklahoma in 2002. This was a hospital-based pain clinic where they used multi-dose syringes, and they loaded the syringes up for multiple uses. So they loaded them up with fentanyl and propofol, enough medication to treat multiple patients. Seemed like a good idea. But then they reused these syringes through a heparin lock, which they thought was the safety factor, into the IV, and the result of that ideal that they thought was safe actually resulted in 71 cases of hepatitis C infection and 31 cases of hepatitis B infection. a large number of infections.
I think that's an example of providers, perhaps with good intentions, doing something that was inherently unsafe in the name of efficiency. But as you can see, that that practice was also a very efficient way of transmitting these life-threatening viruses. Almost 100 patients affected in this example.
And thousands more that had to be evaluated.
Yeah, and again, that's going to be a sort of one of the recurring themes here is that, you know, it's not just the sheer number of patients infected, but hundreds, sometimes tens of thousands of patients requiring notification and living with that uncertainty, you know, as made clear in the example that we opened with. You know, imagine as a parent receiving a letter telling you that your child was potentially exposed to bloodborne viruses during something while receiving routine medical care.
And Joe, it tell us what the investigation involves and the duration that these parents are unsure
right.
of the health of their children.
You know, it's the nature of the hepatitis infections as well as HIV that there's an incubation period. And so if one was exposed, let's say last week, it'll be many months before we can rule out infection. And so healthcare workers go through this when they suffer, for example, a needle stick, which is another aspect of injection safety. But it's something that really weighs heavily on patients who are affected in these incidents and receive such letters.
Now, Robin, you mentioned an example of systems breakdown being intentional malfeasance. I think many of us, myself included, are disturbed by such examples. Could you share one with us?
There are numerous examples in the literature on this, and let's use one particular incident that happened in Colorado in 2009, where a surgery tech that was HCV, hepatitis C virus, infected, and because of a drug habit, then was taking syringes of fentanyl that she was able to find when nobody else was keeping an eye on them. And she had accessory syringes that she had used previously that she then returned in place of these that were filled with just saline or something that then the healthcare provider would think that they still had the drug that they thought that they had. And then she would use that syringe and use that one then next time she wanted to divert some fentanyl. So she had a very good system in place that worked for her to be able to divert that. And the systems that would generally be in place in an institution to keep this from happening clearly failed, whereby syringes are supposed to be labeled with the drug, the concentration, the date, the time, and the initials of the person that were drying it up. And clearly, if this person was taking them home and then bringing them back at a later point, that should have been one point that it could have been picked up and clearly wasn't.
I think many people may assume that an incident like this where there was intentional diversion of an opioid or a narcotic-containing agent, that there's little that can be done to prevent that. But it sounds like what you're saying is that medication safety could at least have multiple checks in place to have potentially caught this diversion much sooner and limited the consequences. What were the consequences? Joe, are you aware of the number of individuals who acquired hepatitis C infection as a result of this?
Sure, yeah. The investigation that was conducted by the Colorado Department of Health with support from CDC ultimately determined that approximately 24 patients acquired hepatitis C virus infection as a result. 6,000 patients had to be notified across two facilities, a hospital and an ambulatory surgical center, where the surgical technician sought employment after they were released from the hospital as a result of the diversion.
Interesting.
So, you know, we've talked about what we have labeled overt or direct syringe reuse, reusing a syringe for more than one patient. And, you know, that's a very serious and concerning error that has manifested repeatedly. But Also, there are other breaches that we need to consider, you know, within the scheme here, and that includes, for example, reusing medications that were never intended for use on multiple patients. And so some of the subsequent examples that we can talk through will illustrate that. We also have issues around low adherence to hand hygiene and general aseptic technique. And I guess it'd probably be good for us to go through some examples of where, you know, rather than direct syringe reuse, we have contamination of a shared medication. And when we're thinking about indirect syringe reuse, what we're talking about is that the syringe is not used for more than one patient, but during a single patient's procedure, the patient may need additional medication. And if a syringe that was already used to administer medication to that patient is now used to withdraw additional medications, those medications become contaminated. And that medication can serve as a source of infection for additional patients. And in the vernacular, this is what we refer to as the double dip. So the Nevada outbreak is maybe a good way to look at that. This involved administration of sedative in an outpatient setting. So Robin, these were anesthesia colleagues who re-entered propofol with a used syringe. And one of the things that I know we found interesting when we discussed this was that there was some risk perception. Providers actually changed the needle on the syringe, which indicates to us, and we've seen this come out in other outbreak investigations and in discussions with healthcare providers, there's a misconception that contamination is limited to the needle. You know, so there's this failure to appreciate that the needle and syringe are, you know, one contiguous unit, and we contaminate the syringe when in the process of injecting a patient with medication.
And Joe, it's also worth emphasizing that contamination of the needle and subsequently the syringe can take place even in the absence of obvious blood contamination in the unit. And I think one of the assumptions is I didn't see blood, therefore, it can't contain a potential blood-borne pathogen.
Yeah, I mean, that again is one of the common misperceptions, and we have to remind providers of the basic fact that germs are very small and we can't see them. And absence of visible blood does not mean an absence of risk. In that Nevada example, I would also emphasize that the medication that was being used, propofol, which is very commonly used for outpatient sedation, is only approved for single patient use. It's a single dose vial. So we see a combination of errors coming into play.
You know, I think that we think of these big centers and big practices where a lot of these errors can happen, but even in where there's a very straightforward practice, sometimes really extraordinary malpractice happens. And that's a good example of what happened in North Carolina in a recent publication in the American Journal of Cardiology. And in this particular outbreak, there was a cardiology clinic practice that was a single physician practice with one technician. And they were doing stress testing. And when they did the stress testing, they used a radiologic pharmaceutical that was drawn up, already made for them, labeled for them, and then a flush had to be done on two occasions after the radiologic was given. Well, the technician was not keeping good track of the multi-dose vials or of the flush solution, was actually using the same syringe to draw up the flush solution as she was for the radiologic materials. And they were, because of the testing order of the patients, the syringes had obviously gotten mixed up because there were, on two separate occasions, happened to have a source case be the first case in the patients for the day, and then subsequently, for on two different dates, five additional cases of hepatitis C transmission. which is a still lower viral load than hepatitis B, but obviously still a risk for cross-transmission. So this was a case where the technician had not received, and nor is it a national standard for the radiologic technicians to be certified, and not enough oversight of their practice.
One of the things that I'm hearing repeatedly, especially in these ambulatory settings where technicians are tasked with multiple different responsibilities, is a lack of formal training in infection control basics, as well oftentimes as a lack of appropriate oversight.
That was actually true in that clinic. In that investigation, there was no infection control plan in place. There was the standard measures were not there, written or otherwise known.
Okay. And again, this slightly more subtle form of syringe reuse involving shared medications actually is the most common cause of the hepatitis outbreaks that we see related to unsafe injection practices. We haven't talked much about transmission of bacterial pathogens in our examples, but it is also quite easy to transmit bacterial pathogens from things like contamination of a single dose vial, reuse of syringes, and just general mishandling of injection equipment and medications, poor aseptic technique.
Especially when single dose vials do not routinely contain a preservative or antiseptic in them, although they're not to be used on multiple patients, that does occur, and that is one factor that contributes to transmission, particularly of bacterial pathogens.
That's right.
One of the things that I wanted to emphasize is there are many permutations on this theme and how the transmission can actually occur. And I get questions a lot about, well, I never reuse vials for a subsequent patient, so why is it necessary for me to use a new needle and syringe? Everything's going to be thrown out at the end. I also have people that are the opposite. Well, I never reuse a syringe. I always use a clean syringe, so what does it matter on that side? And what happens is that we don't practice in a vacuum. We practice alongside many other people. And you may be practicing this way, and your safe controls work because you're doing that, but somebody else's safe controls are different. And unless you have some overlap and what we call a double layer of protection, you can't guarantee that you're not going to get transmission because somebody else is doing something different than you, and they ended up using the same medications that you were using.
Mm-hmm. So, Joe, are there some fundamental take-home points about safe injection practices?
I think so. I think it's important for providers to consider how we put this together, you know, to Robin's point. So, first of all, needles and syringes are single-use devices. This isn't news, but it's something that we all need to understand and follow. So, in other words, needles and syringes should not be used for more than one patient or reused to draw up additional medication, and changing needles does not offer any additional protection. If anything, it puts providers at risk. Likewise, if we limit sharing of medications, we can better achieve this double layer of safety. And to that end, it's important to remind providers that we must not administer medications from a single dose vial or IV bag to multiple patients. Likewise, we should be attempting to limit the use of all shared medications. So that includes vials that are approved by FDA and labeled as multi-dose vials. Even those true multi-dose vials we need to take great care with, and ideally should be using vials in the smallest quantity appropriate for the given clinical application.
One of the areas, I think, of increasing regulatory concern and oversight is the care increasingly given at ambulatory surgical centers and other procedure units. There have been some recent surveys that have focused on safe injection practices and infection control practices within ambulatory surgical centers. Could you share some of that information?
Yeah, you know, actually, as the result of that Nevada outbreak that we talked about, there was an investigation of the practices in the ambulatory surgical centers in Nevada where they saw a number of significant breaches similar to the Nevada problem. And that led then to a collaboration between CDC and CMS to go in and audit three states that had volunteered for their ambulatory surgical centers to be investigated essentially around the country to see how widespread this was. And from those three states, they actually found that 19 of 67 had at least one lapse in infection safety or medication handling. This is not insignificant when 28% of them involved the use of a single-dose medication vial for more than one patient. And there was actually even one case of a pre-filled syringe used for more than one patient, which is, you know, something you wouldn't expect. And one case, of course, of fluid infusion equipment being used for one more than one patient, which has been the source of multiple outbreaks where they're using one setup of a bag that continually gets back entered into. So there were numerous things seen in that three-state audit.
It was personally interesting to me to hear again of examples where large bags of saline are being used for multiple patients to flush central venous catheters. One of the assumptions, perhaps, is that this intravenous fluid cannot support microbial growth. In fact, bacteria do very well. They can grow and multiply, albeit at slightly slower rates, within saline solutions.
Yeah. And another thing that I wanted to bring up out of the collaboration between the CMS and CDC during this audit was an audit tool kit now that is being used by CMS initially for outpatient centers, but is generalized to all centers now, whereby they specifically look for and ask if a new syringe is being used every time a medication is drawn up and a new needle is used every time a medication is drawn up. And if the answer is no to either of those on any occasion, it's an automatic citation. So it's not just theoretical. It's something that is being required now that clinicians do.
So, Joe, you've talked about the three fundamentals of safe injection practices. There's been some recent data about the frequency with which there's lack of adherence to those principles. Could you share some of that information with us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Many of the practices that we identify in the context of outbreak investigation, it turns out, are somewhat prevalent just in terms of, you know, background provider behavior. So a recent survey of 5,500 U.S. healthcare professionals, primarily registered nurses, by the way, indicated that about 1% sometimes or always reused a syringe on a second patient. So that's very disturbing. That's the kind of information where if it came to the attention of, for example, a larger healthcare institution or a health department, we would be seriously considering a patient notification action, even absent any evidence of transmission of infection at that time because of the inherent risk. We also see that approximately 1% of patients, of providers who responded in the survey said that they would reuse a vial after they had accessed it using a reused syringe. So again, the concept of the double dip. So a dangerous adherence gap there. And then likewise, on the order of 6% in that survey indicated that they were reusing single-dose vials, bags, and other containers for multiple patients.
Thanks. So, Robin, you've emphasized, particularly in the practice of anesthesia, an individual can have scrupulous aseptic technique when drawing up and administering medications, particularly for a single or, in some cases, multiple individuals. But inherent in that is a bunch of different assumptions, what we call big ifs. What are some of those assumptions that may, in fact, not be met in clinical practice, particularly given the complexity of patient care?
Well, the ifs that we talk about are, first of all, if you're going to throw away a vial after you use it, then it doesn't matter if you enter that with a syringe that has been previously used and potentially contaminated with bloodborne pathogens. However, the falsity here is that we see that that system is not 100%. Therefore, if a single vial makes it through, you're putting subsequent patients at risk.
Well, again, there are these assumptions that that we make, and they're sometimes predicated on the idea that we're never interrupted, or things never go wrong, or, as you pointed out earlier, Robin, that everybody's doing it the way I do it, and those are big ifs. So one that I hear is, well, if I always use a new needle and syringe to draw medications, then it's okay to reuse the vials.
And your colleague may not be using a new needle and syringe, and now you have a combination of vials that are contaminated and vials that aren't, and that leaves a risk factor.
Certainly does.
So it we've mentioned several times the personal justification that is used for a reuse of needles or syringes. But I think the point to emphasize is that there is risk anytime you share a medication, whether it is a single dose vial, the risk is clear. Even when it's a multi-dose vial using scrupulous aseptic technique, getting back fundamentally to this idea of one needle, one syringe, one time.
That's right. And, to the extent that we can get to, single medication per patient, that's going to take safety to another level. There are circumstances and times in which, it's appropriate and safe to use multi-dose vials for multiple patients, but we need to take great care in those situations. I think for too long there's been a blind spot around the issue of sharing of vials and containers. Mm-hmm. It's a blind spot that's not there when we think about, for example, surgical equipment or endoscope equipment or so on. We realize that in order to reuse those, great care must be taken. Mm-hmm. And with medication vials, there's no equivalent to, reprocessing the vial. Mm-hmm. It has to be maintained in a sterile condition if it's going to be used for subsequent patients.
We've had some pretty dramatic examples today, particularly of bloodborne pathogen exposure events to hepatitis B and C. One of the important things to keep in mind is that these may simply represent the tip of the iceberg. There needs to be a confluence of different events for these exposures to be identified. What we've also indicated is that there are multiple opportunities within routine clinical practice around injection of medications that on a daily, if not hourly basis, could potentially put a patient at risk. Sometimes outbreak detection relies upon serendipity. A patient presenting with an unusual pathogen growing out of the bloodstream, a sharp clinician recognizing a cluster of infections. Have there been some recent examples with significant health consequences of transmission of bloodborne pathogens, and how were those events detected?
So some of the examples that we talked about involved identification of two cases, sometimes even just one case. Actually, the North Carolina example that Karen took us through, that began with identification of a single patient. He was a routine blood donor and learned from the agency through which he was donating blood that he was suddenly infected with hepatitis C virus. And, of course, that caused him great concern. He called the health department, and the health department, took note of it and was able to get an investigation started that uncovered an outbreak. Likewise, in Nebraska, several years back, a really painful example of poor injection practices leading to terrible consequence, adverse impact on patients. This was an outbreak of hepatitis C virus in an oncology clinic. And this was a situation where patients were presenting for life-saving therapy. Many of them had implanted catheters. And before initiating chemotherapy, those catheters had to be assessed for their patency, and that involved doing a flush procedure. And this is an example, again, David, of a saline bag being used for multiple patients. The provider there, for some reason, thought it was okay to take the syringe that they had used to test the patency of the implanted catheter and then access saline to do a flush. Shockingly, some patients reported that they noticed that the bag, which was used for the whole course of the day for many patients that were receiving care, actually had a pinkish tint to it, if you can believe that. And that outbreak, believe it or not, despite its size, almost 100 patients with documented infection, was almost missed. It wasn't detected until a year later. So again, you know, your points about outbreak detection being haphazard are very real. And it's not just bloodborne pathogens, it's also the bacterial pathogens, where unless a cluster of patients appears at a particular inpatient facility, we may not be able to connect the dots.
And even once you do connect the dots, there can be a delay of a year or more, and consequently many, many transmissions.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we don't always, you know, follow the path back. There is an assumption still that, you know, healthcare is somehow inherently safe. So when patients present with viral or bacterial infections, we often, I'm afraid, don't make the link back to the substandard care involving poor injection practice.
One thing that I wanted to mention at this point is sometimes it would be almost impossible to track it back. It's difficult enough to track it back when you're able to go and see that there are unsafe injection practices happening. It would be just about impossible to go back and find it when it was one of the inadvertent lapses in infection control.
Yeah, again, that's very troubling. Imagine, you know, that people make mistakes, and you know, short of an outbreak, we can have sporadic transmission, which I feel we need to get a handle on and do our best to prevent.
And these outbreak investigations have a great cost for the public health department in terms of pull on their services and availability as well. So when they could be doing other things, they're pulled into these very expensive and elaborate investigations.
Yeah, and not to mention, you know, it's worth reminding providers that you know, this can be very devastating. Not only to their patients, but to their livelihood, to their practice. Outbreaks and incidents of the type that we've described have resulted in notification of licensing boards and, you know, numerous malpractice suits and the like.
For example, the cardiology clinic practice was closed for over a year after the outbreak that I described in that practice.
Thanks. So we've heard repeatedly of a lack of knowledge, a lack of adherence, and some really dramatic examples of intentional malfeasance. What resources are out there, have been developed, to help providers and those who they supervise provide optimal medical care around the area of medication safety and safe injection practices?
Well, I think a good starting place is evidence-based guidelines, and namely, going back to standard precautions as developed by CDC and its advisory committee for infection control practices. So we do have clear guidelines that lay out the basics of safe injection practices. People need to understand that safe injection practices are part of standard precautions and really do need to be considered the standard of care. Education, of course, is very important. We don't want providers to say that they didn't know better. So we're trying to raise awareness through educational efforts such as this and broadly through the activities of the Safe Injection Practices Coalition and its one and only campaign. But the role of oversight is also worth emphasizing.
So one of the things that came from that infection control worksheet and that work that was done by the CDC and CMS is expanding this really to all healthcare settings. So they're in the process now of developing a model from the infection control worksheet for ambulatory surgical settings, which is available on their website of CDC as well as CMS, an infection control worksheet for acute care, and eventually a worksheet for long-term care. So this is now in development and will probably be available for public comment in a few months. And it will look at the entire infection control program, but of course a heavy emphasis on safe injection practices.
Something else that CDC has done recently is to take the existing guidance and distill information for outpatient settings. And so that is currently available from CDC and in many ways complements the work that we're doing with partners like CMS, who are emphasizing oversight and enforcement. So we have tools through which providers can proactively do their own assessment. There's no need to wait for the state survey agency to come knocking on the door.
So there are some carrots out there as well as a pending stick.
Indeed.
So how could we summarize the critical points about safe injection practices as they apply to the continuum of healthcare?
I think it's important that all providers understand that every injection should be a safe injection. And the time really is ripe for us to take stock of this, you know, as a nation, as a healthcare system. In many ways, I'm beginning to feel like injection safety is the new hand hygiene. Mm. Think of all the awareness around hand hygiene. There's still a lot of room for improvement, but we've done a pretty good job of emphasizing that as an element of basic infection control. And likewise, I think safe injection practices should be viewed as a very basic element of basic patient safety, patient protections, infection prevention. So one thing that we would emphasize is that healthcare providers really should take a moment to review medication preparation and administration procedures with their staff and colleagues. Again, to assure that safe practices are followed by all and to make certain that every injection is a safe one.
You know, I think the technology has really just expanded and the care has been pushed out to outpatient care without the infection control program backing and supervision and oversight that we had in acute care facilities for decades. And the movement of bloodborne pathogens has moved from being a reservoir of healthcare worker exposing patients to patient-to-patient transmission. And this is a big change that I think all settings have to catch up with, is those risks and then how to prevent them, which those strategies are available on the websites that we've provided.
So thank you for participating in this activity. To proceed to the online CME and CE post-test, please click on the Earn CME CE credit link on this page.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Unsafe Injection Practices, Outbreaks, Incidents, and Root Causes. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.